The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY with no spaces. And you'll save an additional 20% on these already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout to save big. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. For some reason, that took me a lot longer to remember how to switch over my video. So first of all, OBS just recently updated. So the UI is just ever so slightly different than what I've been using for a while. So I'm looking at the icons and the images and going, I think I pushed this button. I'm trying to get it to flip over. I hope you all have had a fantastic weekend. This is going to be a really loose show. My mic is really hot. I'm kind of clipping here, so I'm going to turn myself way down. Let me know if I just vanished off of your headphones. I'm trying not to blow out people's ears. This is going to be kind of a looser show today. I don't have the most tightly constructed, noted show. We've got a lot of tech news to talk about. We've got some fun stuff to cover, but I'm trying to keep this one a bit more casual. And there's a lot of stuff that's just going to be sort of me editorializing about stuff that's going on around me. Like, for example, I want to start off this week in, how hard it is to be a YouTuber. I had a really interesting experience last week and over the weekend trying to work with a PR agency to do some coverage for a new laptop. They wanted to sponsor some content. I was really looking forward to working with them. And then it was like every step of the process just got a little sketchier and a little sketchier and a little sketchier. And you know, it's one of the reasons why, like on my channel, you don't see a ton of sponsored content. It takes me a long time to vet contracts and work with agencies and put together what I think is reasonable, like the amount of work it takes to make that happen versus the impact it has on a channel where everything is sponsored and everything is sort of an ad or is sort of leveraging that audience. And my audience isn't that big. So anything that might sort of upset or, disrupt that audience relationship, I take very, very seriously. So this year I've only done one. I did a Google Fi sponsorship because I literally do still use Google Fi. So it felt like it was a good synergistic relationship to talk about and to do for a sponsored post. But I'm working with this agency and I have Danger Will Robinson red flags from the very beginning where it's like, well, hey, we want you to do this and then we're going to let you keep the laptop. And they're like, okay, well, cool. What are the financials? Like, there's no pay. You just get to keep this really nice laptop. Okay. I want to build new relationships and work with new clients. So, you know, send over a contract and I'll look over the contract and we'll see what the deliverables look like. And then from there, we can decide if we want to work together. Oh, we can't send over the contract. I should have just stopped right there. I should have just stopped talking to them right there. I was like, well, I can't agree to be a part of this program if I don't know exactly what I'm agreeing to. And so then it became this really like nebulous conversation on what the deliverables would be. And it's going to be really easy. And you just want like 9 pieces of content. Well, 9 pieces of content could be 9 in-depth YouTube videos, or it could be 9 pictures on Instagram. Got to narrow that down. And I'm frustrated that I took this much time. It was days of emailing back and forth, and like, really, I should bill them for my time. But we eventually hammer out all this stuff, like, okay, I'll do this YouTube video and we'll do this kind of Instagram thing. And then I'll also use it to stream an episode of my podcast. You know, I feel like that's a good spread. You're getting Twitch and Instagram and YouTube. And like, yeah, I think that's appropriate, especially because it's not really for money. It's just to keep a piece of product. And then I get the contract and it is that. I mean, they do have listed exactly what I said for the deliverables, but it's like, we have the right for multiple revisions. We can make you reshoot up to 3 times. You cannot post anything else on your social media for a certain amount of time before and after every social media post. You cannot work any content for competing products during the length of the campaign. So they're holding this like, they're holding these exceptions. It's just, if you just sent me the contract on day one, I would have said, oh, this doesn't look like the right fit for me. Thanks. You know, I wish you all the best. It's nothing personal. It's just, this is not the kind of channel that I run and I'm a solo content creator. And we could have just parted ways right there. And instead it took a week and I still arrived at the same place where I started. I was like, I don't really have a good feeling about this. You're telling me everything's going to be super chill, but then your contract is sort of the opposite. And it was just a very frustrating experience. It's very easy. Like, I complain about YouTube ad revenue. I complain about monetization and being demonetized. And one of the reasons why is because YouTube's promise was always being a facilitator. You know, we're going to set you up with advertising. And instead, I mean, one of the ways that you monetize more heavily is by doing these types of sponsored posts, sponsored content. But I don't think people always realize, like, the amount of work that goes into the back end is incredible. It's not just making the piece of content that gets sponsored. It's everything else that you need to fulfill. Like, before you have the conversation, I've got to send a ton of screenshots on what my demographics look like and what my views look like and reach and all of these other social media metrics just to start the conversation. And then after that, it's like, well, now that you've posted the piece of content, you need to screenshot every 24 hours for the next 3 days, and you need to submit this, and then you need to invoice, and then you need to fill out this contract, and then you need to do this document. And by the time I break that all down, most of the time I'm looking at some kind of sponsored post or sponsored content. It's like, man, if I had just gotten a job at In-N-Out hourly, I'd probably be doing better just flipping burgers. This was, you know, not worth my time, let alone, you know, on top of that, I also had to make some decent content that doesn't wreck my channel, so that it's not just, you know, low effort, you know, sponsored ads that are going to turn people off and make people not want to come back to my channel. And it's pretty heady stuff. You know, again, I've sort of made it my promise that I'm going to be airing a bit more of my dirty laundry, just so that you folks know what the relationship looks like. Steve Becker, sponsored by Raid Shadow Legends, NordVPN. This podcast, absolutely not. I'm not getting that tasty Raid Shadow Legends money from Al's Bockley. But you get a laptop. And see, and this is what's frustrating. Like, Q3 Becker, don't you want free stuff? We just have to own you for a week or so. Yeah, it wasn't a week, man. The timeline that we had on this campaign was going to be roughly 3 months. And I was down for just the content, because it actually would have fit into my review style. Like, I pitched an intro video, a live stream, a topic, you know, like using the laptop in another video to talk about some of the functionality of the laptop. And I'd still have to disclose that it was sponsored, but I think it would have been good content for the channel that I probably would have made anyway. And then a long-term review. The details of their contract as written, and again, I come out of Hollywood, like I used to work at a talent agency. They were holding a conflict for the entire length of the campaign where I would not have been able to post content about competing manufacturers for that entire time. And like, if you've ever worked in Hollywood, if you've ever worked in commercials, like that's a huge no-no. Like, you can't tell me I can't make competing stuff and then not pay for the exclusivity of me being tied up for that long. So I had to send the other, wish you the best of luck. I'm really sorry. This is not going to work. But it was still the frustration of like, I should send you an invoice for how much time we spent emailing. Like, I need you to understand, if you had just sent me the contract at the very beginning, we wouldn't have tied up this amount of time in back and forth communications. It's hilarious. So, I'm seeing some great faces, some great chatter already in the live chat. A couple people have been commenting on my hat. This is one of the coolest ball caps that you can own, especially from someone with such a prodigious beard. Those of you listening to the audio version of the podcast, apologies that you can't see how amazing this ball cap is. We need to cover some housekeeping because I had another pretty decently busy week getting stuff out. And then also we had sort of the fun of my website almost crashing because I don't know where you were when YouTube went down, but one of the nice things about being really persnickety about YouTube is, you know, just as a matter of principle, I've been backing up most of my videos, not all, but almost all of my videos on Twitch. I'm streaming this podcast on Twitch. I'm trying to live this truth of not putting all of my eggs in the YouTube basket and trying to diversify. So when YouTube went down, I was in kind of a rare position to still have my entire catalog of videos basically still streamable. So I'm putting out some snarky tweets like, hey, YouTube's down, but you can still watch my review of the V60. And here's a video about the Wing. And here's some Microsoft Surface Duo content. And like, I got that love hug of death from people on Twitter. Like, there were so many folks who just wanted to watch a tech video and couldn't on YouTube and came crashing down on my site. So I'd like to reiterate, if you watch my videos on YouTube, I mean, the nice thing about YouTube is that there is a much better fleshed out comments section. So you can, not that anyone ever really engages in much of a conversation, but the comments are more robust. But if you go to somegadgetguy.com, there is a higher quality version of every video I put out stored on Twitch. And then, of course, on the Patreon is where you get the full 4K 60 frame per second video for all the content that I make. And that's, you know, that's Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. But yeah, somegadgetguy.com, better quality videos. So from Dave Burns, hey, I comment all the time. It's not the individual comments. It's the reality of what YouTube has done to comments has kind of wrecked the conversations. And if you notice, like, I still sit in the YouTube comments more than I should, but there are very few replies. This is a huge change from even a couple years back where someone would drop a comment and you would see this conversation flourish. And instead now it's basically just, you know, getting to the comment is a touch more difficult. And now there's very little interaction between various people watching those videos. Again, it's like YouTube took another step away from what makes a community healthier and more vibrant and makes a community actually thrive. And instead now it's just whatever kind of like a shouting into the void feeling. And it's sad. I've got my silver play button down here. I'm going to save that at the end for that part of the conversation. Dave Burns, the YouTube doom scroll. So yeah, let's knock out some housekeeping because I've already kind of rambled on a little bit. And let me get this out of the way here. And let me scroll down here. And let me see if I can figure out how screen sharing works again on OBS after this update. Success. All right. So kicking off last week. Well, first of all, the same day as the podcast, we finally had the proper embargo lift for the OnePlus Nord. The OnePlus Nord N10, a phone that's actually coming to North America, hitting very low price points, sharing some initial thoughts where, again, it's I feel it's a disservice to the phone if we just complain that some other device can be cheaper or more powerful or what's going on, because the realities of doing business in North America are very different than what OnePlus is having to contend with in other markets. And so after that, I finally put out a sort of a longer term look at the Pixel 5. And so the title Pixel 5 review for folks who like little phones. This is something I'm really trying to hold to a slightly different review style, where instead of just reviewing the phone on its merits, I'm trying. I don't know how well I'm succeeding, and someone please let me know if I'm really not achieving this, but I'm trying to anticipate who a Pixel 5 consumer might be, and I'm trying to craft that conversation to someone who is genuinely interested in buying the phone. That sounds really easy. That sounds really like high-minded and like, well, of course, all reviewers are looking at consumers who might want to buy the phone. But even in my own review style, I find that most of the videos that I make are often trafficked by people who already threw their money at their preferred solution. And more often than not, it's someone coming to the video after they've already spent money to confirm their bias. And most of the time, it's someone who's already spent money on an iPhone or a Galaxy looking to confirm that they made the right purchasing decision in not buying a Sony, an LG, a Pixel, a OnePlus, a Motorola, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't like that. I feel the person who is genuinely interested in shopping a Pixel 5 right now deserves the same care, consideration, and conversation as someone who's interested in buying a Galaxy. There are innumerable videos talking about how smart a decision it is to buy an iPhone 12 or a Galaxy S20. You don't get the same kind of conversation when you're looking at Pixels, LGs, Sonys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, Dave Burns, why would you do research after the purchase, like the FOMO for these phones when QA issues aren't even documented yet? I mean, like, that's where I've been kind of concerned about our tech conversation. It's that double whammy. We know statistically more people are going to buy Samsung and Apple than any other manufacturers. That's easy. But that causes a feedback loop on YouTube. They're more popular, so they get pushed more. And so then you end up in this really weird space where the entertainment of a tech review is all about patting you on the back for being the savvy, smart consumer who bought the right thing, because then that feeds back into the YouTube popularity metrics and everyone feels real good about being on the winning team. And I find that to be a bit unseemly. Again, most of the products that have come out this year have genuinely been good, and we can have some fun debates about price performance and some of the feature sets, but I haven't found a single deal breaker device this year. I really haven't. From Sony's to the Surface Duo, I feel there are good faith arguments to be made, and that the conversation we need to have is how broad. You know, my recommendation for a Surface Duo is super positive. I mean, incredibly high-level positive for a very narrow band of consumers out there. And again, I feel like that conversation gets lost. The person who is genuinely going to love a Surface Duo or a Pixel 5, they deserve the same positive review as any of their other smartphone contemporaries. We just have to work harder to make sure that that information really gets to the person who that phone would be the right fit for. And we also need to, you know, the disclaimer, if you're not interested in buying a Pixel 5, nothing in my video is going to convince you that it's the right phone for you. But that's fair, right? That's actually being fair. I'm telling you, if this phone isn't doing it for you, there's nothing I'm going to say that's going to change your mind. But the flip side needs to hold just as accurate. You know, tech reviewers can't fall back on this, well, if that's what you're into, kind of BS, right? That's really condescending and it's kind of crappy. Instead, I want that person who picks up a Pixel 5 for themselves to be just as excited for their new purchase as someone who's getting a Note 20 Ultra, someone who's getting a top-of-the-line Oppo, someone who's getting that iPhone 12 Pro Max. They deserve to feel just as good. Matt Tyler, Joe Hickey is a perfect example of who the Pixel 5 is for. Matt is not so subtly plugging his show Across the Podcast with Sam and Matt, where Joe was a guest and actually was a really fun conversation. I love the show that Sam and Matt put together, so you should definitely, you know, check it out. It's good times. From Utaku, I do it the other way around. I like to watch videos confirming that what I got have very good features that I like compared to what my other options were. I tend to change my mind a lot when in doubt. And again, I feel like that's fine from an entertainment standpoint, but it's also like it's infuriating when you're genuinely trying to shop some different solutions and instead all you come across is confirmation bias. So it's tricky. Let me get back. This is going to be a real rambling podcast. I can already feel it. I don't have my notes really sorted like I should. After that, I had a little fun with a tiny form factor PC. This is the Azul Access 4. A review on a full Windows 10 PC costs around $270-$280. Literally fits in the palm of my hand and has Ethernet, a headphone jack, USB 3, and a DisplayPort out with a little cute little Wi-Fi antenna. This is not my normal review fare. I mean, I love playing with like Intel Nooks. I really, really do dig on tiny small form factor PCs. So obviously my channel's a bit more mobile focused, but this also kind of fits into some similar idea. Really exciting, fun little product. And my recommendation is a very narrow band kind of recommendation. A lot of what makes this cool could easily be fulfilled by a streaming stick, right? Like I just got, thanks to hashtag Team Pixel, hashtag gift from Google, I finally got a Chromecast with Google TV. And, you know, I really wanted the mission of the Chromecast to succeed, but having a remote control that fully removes me from the terrible interface on my Samsung TV is kind of nice. So very positive on that. I'm going to have a write-up on the website. I'm probably not going to shoot a video on it, but just it's such a good solution for fixing how terrible most smart TVs are. So when you look at something like a really tiny small form factor PC for consumers, a lot of the functionality that could be easily fulfilled by a less expensive streaming stick. But there's still this idea in my brain of having more control over content, having better web services. You know, again, it's a full Windows PC. So there's still something in there that I think is interesting, even though I think the majority of people who might be interested in a product like this are definitely a bit more corporate focused, right? It's a thin client. It's you can connect to your company's infrastructure. It's not super powerful. You're not going to edit videos on it. It's not really the solution. But you plug it into a TV and it's a really, you know, functional full computing device. There's something in there where I still feel, especially in an age where we're all trying to like work in school from home, something in there kind of makes sense. You know, like you spend $270, you plug it into your TV and maybe you hook up a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard and you've got a functioning computer for a kid's school if they're doing remote or distance learning. That kind of works. So again, I hope to keep that conversation a bit more present for what people are going through these days, especially because like anything that's kind of cheap and still gets the job done for document work and streaming video is kind of a good fit, since people don't seem to believe me that you can do it all on your phone. Wrapping out the week, this was one of the most fun videos I've had to put together in a while. Of course, the LG Wing review. This phone is so unique and fun, and it's a little bit weird and different. And for all the people that love to complain, like, of course, I put out the video and like, well, LG lost me as a customer because they have the worstest software support. And you're like, you didn't watch the video and you're not paying attention, because what LG is doing with software, especially considering how Android is not good at this stuff, is pretty remarkable. Like, we're going to talk about Galaxy S21 leaks and rumors. And like a major feature that's coming to the S21 that people seem to be excited about is dual video recording. You can record video off the front and back cameras at the same time. And you're like, yeah, the Wing on a mid-ranger processor does that now. Like you can, it just does. This is not magic. what are we getting excited about with ever increasing expensive premium phones if it's not empowering different use? And I'm very pleasantly surprised that the Wing for this, you know, what makes the Wing a little bit more fragile, a little less water resistant, does empower different kinds of use than a non-swivel hinge phone. And so, again, just like my Pixel 5 review, I really tried to write that script. If you're interested, if you're really thinking about throwing some money at the Wing, that's the conversation I'm trying to have. If you're just wanting me to tell you that it's fun because it's weird, but it's better to buy a regular phone. It's safer, you know, if you just want regular, that's not the video I'm interested in making. So, Zhao Rallis, how is LG nowadays with updates? Like, you know, they could always improve, but kind of like Samsung, they're running so much custom software. They're actually doing pretty good. My V60 is now falling a little farther behind on security patches than I would normally like, but it's still getting regular software, regular patches, regular bug fixes. Apps, individual LG apps are getting updated better. And I would imagine we're probably going to be last in line or near last in line. No, I take that back. Nokia will still probably be worst with their premium phones getting full major Android updates. But I think LG will probably lag, you know, OnePlus and Samsung pretty bad for the full OS update. But at the same time, what LG is doing on these dual display and swivel screen and stylus enabled phones is pretty remarkable. It's some of the best software and UI I've seen from this company ever. So, you know, you take some wins, you take some losses, but having radically different hardware changes that conversation in a very significant way. And it's kind of like the same thing with the Surface Duo. It's the same thing with a BlackBerry. You don't judge the BlackBerry by being the most Android device. You judge it by having a very unique feature set that enables you to get your work done. And that's what LG's doing here too. There is literally nothing like the Wing, and the software to make that work is pretty substantial. So, Steve is right. None of the LG are on Android 11. I mean, what's the timetable? I mean, we have one UI coming out, and Samsung's are now starting to tick that over. OnePluses are properly on Android 11 after the OnePlus 8T. Sony's are going to be late. The Xperia ones, they're promising up to Android 13, but they're going to be probably end of first quarter, maybe second quarter 2021. Again, it's not to say that's okay, but the realities of crafting the software experience and improving it in a substantial way when it seems like Android 11 is bringing just a bit more in this update than when we went from Android 9 to Android 10. Going from Android 10 to Android 11 with custom software seems to be a bit more of a challenge. So we're still kind of playing that same game. I will say, though, maybe some people are complaining about some of the carrier and branded phones. That's another thing, too. It's going to slow down LG because there is no unlocked version. And I know that's going to be frustrating for a lot of folks out there. But when these phones don't sell unlocked, you stop making them unlocked. So we'll have to see. Oh, and Matt Tyler is saying Oppo also have Android 11 currently rolling out. But apparently on Oppo, they just lost their security rating, so you can only stream in Netflix on standard definition. So, you know, maybe that's good, maybe it's not. Sorry, I couldn't help myself there. All right, and lastly, just wrapping up housekeeping, I'm really glad I didn't ask for an over-under because I'm all over the place here. I did put out a standalone video, my silver play button arriving almost a year later, celebrating 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, which I broke last November. So it was roughly 11 months to get my silver play button from the time that I completed the requirements for breaking 100,000 subscribers and keeping up all my views and metrics and stuff. And that video was a very difficult video to put together. My feelings, we're going to talk about this a little bit later in this podcast too. My feelings are very complicated on my relationship with Google versus the amazing community of people that I've been interacting with thanks to these various social media platforms. So I've got it right here. This is the silver play button. Not quite as nice as the old school silver play button where the button used to be like a nicer metal button. Now it's kind of a wood frame with a mirror. It's nice. One of the things, and be thinking of this, folks, in this live chat, I'm a little torn as to what to do with this button. I don't want to do anything disrespectful. I mean, that's not really what I'm trying to accomplish. My commentary is trying to make YouTube better, not just throwing a thumb in the eye of people who work at YouTube. But at the same time, I don't know that I want to put this up where it's going to be visible in all of my videos. I'm not sure that's the kind of commentary I want to support. So be thinking, what would you do with a silver play button? Where would you mount it? Or would you just put it away and put it in a closet? I'm honestly a little torn as to what to do with this thing. So, Boang Bite, some cookie button guy. Those cookies came out good. My wife found a really buttery sugar cookie recipe. So I don't like sickly sweet, but, you know, butter. You want to fire up the synapses in my brain. And that cookie cutter came by way of Fat Produce, Andrew Wallace, a very good friend of mine, someone I've met through these online communities and has become an actual true blue friend. And as a joke, he sent it over to me. And yet, like in the video, I say, like, I'm sitting here, this silly little gag gift of a cookie cutter means more to me because it came from someone that I really like. I really appreciate, you know, as someone who's really become a brother at arms in this online stuff. So, let's Geet Madden. If it doesn't give you joy, Marie Kondo, that ish. we were joking about that on the Discord pretty hard because I'm having to do my like bi-yearly Gadget Lab clean out. I can't turn around in this office right now. I have way too much stuff all over the floors. But yeah, it's been Like all of this stuff brings me joy. What does not bring me joy is not being able to turn around in the office. So I do want to cover some news. We do have some tech and politics. This is going to be a pretty Apple heavy news block also, just because, you know, they've been making the headlines. The announcement of the new laptops, all of the iPhone 12 videos that are out and hitting the web. And so I feel like the counterbalance to some of this conversation is to also talk about Apple business practices, where we take for granted Apple is good, and then we judge other manufacturers by much stricter standards. And I don't think that's fair. Nothing I'm going to say today in the Apple block should dissuade someone from buying or owning an Apple product. But we should talk about Apple in the same tone that we discuss when a Microsoft update fails for Windows 10. We should talk about this in the same way that we should talk about our concerns over privacy when we bring up Google. Apple shouldn't be immune to these things because they're popular. And this is exactly why we're in a position where we're in kind of weird territory for trying to regulate the tech sector. Apple contributes to that conversation, and we should be able to talk about them and not like smash or slam someone who genuinely enjoys the products, but we're still talking about a $1 trillion company, and they should be held to certain regulatory and consumer standards. So we're going to dig into that just a bit. And from Rue Sunshine, the new M1 chip that Apple announced, they're head turners. I'm very excited about the chip. I'm really frustrated with how Apple is presenting the chip.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r/glowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
From Al Spockley, there's a whole cadre of reviewers that are basically making their living by acting as an extended arm of Apple marketing. So the tricky thing is, from my own personal experiences, Samsung PR is probably the most punitive. When you get written off the list for Samsung PR, it's pretty brutal. But Apple PR really isn't that far behind. There's a very limited list of approved Apple cheerleaders that get special consideration and special access. And I think that kind of contributes to that echo chamber effect that I talked about earlier. You know, you don't want to upset the Apple cart, pun intended, and it's good for your channel. It's good for your channel to confirm the bias of people who are already predisposed to liking Apple products. But it's always been my assertion that that's how you get worse products. If you never confront or if you never critique, and beyond this, like, gimmicky clickbait, Apple's biggest mistake with the iPhone 12. And then the video's like, well, I just wish they'd come out with a version in metallic electric neon pink. And you're like, that's not a criticism of Apple's business practices. And again, it kind of contributes to a warped discussion of what we should expect from a leader in the telecommunications space. It's always been my assertion that I feel we should be more critical of companies at the top, not excusing their behavior because they're popular. And again, when I really like a product, it's like I want to hold that company to a higher standard and make sure that they continue to deliver and execute products, you know, in the best possible way they can. So, let's get through this news, because I want to start with tech and politics, and that's always gross. And we're going through just a mess of political social media right now. Again, if companies like Facebook wanted to verify
how terrible their platforms are for discourse. They're doing a really good job of it these days. And so it's all mired in this gamesmanship and hypocrisy. And one of the trends that I found kind of most distasteful was this sudden surge of claiming free speech while actively acting as a machine for misinformation. This is a story coming by way of NPR, which I think does a good job of sort of highlighting or detailing this recent trend. Conservatives flock to Mercer-funded Parler, claim censorship on Facebook and Twitter. So from the article, this was written up by Shannon Bond. And there's like a 4-minute, this was actually a broadcast story on NPR. Maria Bartiromo, I actually don't know how to pronounce her name. Maria Bartiromo, the Fox Business host, declared herself done with Twitter 2 days after the election. She tweeted a link to an article that falsely claimed Democrats were trying to steal the election. Twitter hid the post behind a label warning that it contained misleading content. Twitter also notified Bartiromo that someone had complained about her account, even though it did clarify that she had not violated any rules and it was taking no action against her. For Bartiromo, the label was the last straw. Quote, "This is the same group who abused power in 2016, Bartiromo tweeted to her nearly 900,000 followers. "I will be leaving soon and going to Parler. Please open an account on @Parler right away." So I want to pull this up. I just want to see. So here's Maria Bartiromo's Twitter. The same group who abused power in 2016. So this was published November 5th. "I'm going to be leaving soon and going to Parler." She's saying she's going to walk away from Twitter. So let's see. 50 minutes ago, she tweeted. An hour ago, she tweeted. An hour ago, she tweeted. 2 hours ago, she tweeted. 2 hours ago, she tweeted. 22 hours ago, she tweeted. 24 hours ago, she tweeted. A day ago, she tweeted, tweeted, tweeted. And almost none of these are proper retweets. They're all new hosted tweets. So she has not left and gone to Parler. She is trying to move more people over to Parler, but she cannot escape the irrelevance of being some type of social figure, public figure, and leaving Twitter. So this is kind of what I mean when I discuss this sort of gross hypocrisy. You're not really some agent of free speech. We're talking about like the people who have, sort of empowered this conversation. Once you start content curation and you start fact checking, you're introducing bias. So when we get these conservative commentators and these conservative pundits, you can't fact check me, because that's against my free speech. I feel like that's the least conservative thing you could assert. Again, this sort of the notion of old school cloth coat Republican conservative values. I feel in previous generations, even back to like the Reagan administration, someone who actively said, "You can't call me out when I'm lying, because that's bad," would have been laughed out of the room. We're now saying the quiet parts out loud. And this is an incredible twist. I mean, it's like 1984 style twist on how we talk about politics, on how we talk about laws and elections and how we interact with each other as communities with different goals. We're not having a meeting of the mind. We're literally arguing about the fabric of reality, and the people who are most apt to melt like snowflakes are now running off to form their own safe spaces for conservative conversations because they're not allowed to lie to people on more mainstream platforms. "You won't let me spread disinformation. That's against my First Amendment rights. So I'm going to go and make my own Twitter with blackjack and Sorry, I was trying to remember the Bender quote. Yeah, and Boeing Bite. And this is all coming from people who punt these things like a Ben Shapiro, like facts don't care about your feelings. So here's the thing about Parler. Every single time we've seen some mass exodus from a social media platform because of the liberal bias on fact-checking, it doesn't last very long. I don't know if you remember, like, back in, I want to say it was 2017, when there was that whole Reddit meltdown and a bunch of people went to GOAT, a place to share their own, you know, social networked or social media news site sharing service. It didn't last long. And it's frustrating because one of the reasons why it didn't last long is because there's a core group of these types of bad actors who also thrive on upsetting people. So a lot of these people live on this outrage generating machine. And if they don't get the validation of clicks and likes and retweets and replies and comments, and mostly from people who are angry with what they've said, they're not going to stay in their own echo chamber. They want to upset people on the more mainstream platforms. A huge part of this is also that whole liberal tears community. They're not going to sit and just hang out with other like-minded conservatives patting each other on the back for believing things that aren't true. They want to go out and make noise and get reactions. So Parler is going to soar in this really contentious election season, which I still haven't found any data to suggest that the election results are incorrect and that our current presidential administration is nearly acting in ways to give aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States by not empowering a smooth transition of power, which I believe is one of the potential definitions of treasonous behavior, IMO, and instead jumping on to a conversation about where we go from here. And we can't really keep having it both ways. You can't say, well, liberals need to reach out and mend fences and build bridges. And then at the same time, I'm going to take my ball and go to Parler because I don't believe in any of this truth. It's lame. It's really lame and it's sad. Dave Burns, outrage pundits are a scourge, makes me want to leave social media entirely, weaponize people's fear to a point of violent outburst. And again, and it's not just that, it's the fact that that outrage cycle empowers companies like Facebook. You know, the recent stories of Facebook pivoting away from any type of liberal media and gaming their own algorithms so that the content that showed up in people's feeds was of a very specific flavor of political discourse. Yeah, I would still encourage most people to walk away. I keep some token presence on Facebook because of my work, and I engage on Twitter probably more often than I probably should. But the more meaningful interactions that I've been having have been on group texts, on Discord, and on private communities that I set up where it's not even about whether or not we all agree. It's literally not about making the same kind of echo chamber. It's just like I make friends on the internet and then I want to protect those friend conversations from just general internet schmutz kind of sticking to it. And I would say get out and find other avenues of communication. Reach out and just set up an email thread and talk to people directly again. Don't just shout into social media expecting attention. And I think you're all going to be way happier for it. And it's a bummer. The mission of social media can still be achieved. You know, the stated mission, I should say, of social media can still be achieved. But it's becoming more and more difficult to cut through all of this noise and mess and get to relationships and conversations of substance. It's Boeing Bite. Smoke signals work, right? Not in California, they don't. We have our states on fire enough times out of the year. It's a bad smoke screen for smoke signals. All right. Let's move on to some other techier topics. One of the other stories that I think it was kind of surprising. It was kind of surprising how many different takes and how much protection over the idea, how many people were defending the Switch. And well, okay, from our last story, it's not surprising when any story drops that's a little controversial that you get a highly polarized, you know, people defending it and people attacking it kind of social media split. But I'm highlighting this one article here. This is from 10.medium.com, written up by Will Oramus. And I'm talking about the recent news that Google Photos was going to stop allowing all Android devices unlimited high-quality photo backup. And so the article is called Google Photos Just Made the Case for Breaking Up Big Tech. And obviously, this is a little clickbaity. Obviously, when you check out something like this, it's got a bit of a bent. It's very vogue and fashionable to hammer Google for anything that's like antitrust, anti-consumer, privacy related. But Will makes a very good point about sort of an online service strategy, which does feel a little like a bait and switch. It doesn't, there isn't any grand insight into the inner workings of Google. There's no direct reply from anyone in Google PR, but Google sets up a service and they're an internet institution, right? You know, Gmail is a bedrock foundation service for so many people out there. YouTube has become this singular monolithic you know, you talk about video streaming and you talk about YouTube. You know, they're almost synonymous with each other, looking at traffic and stuff. And so Google Photos was this fun extra little add-on. You know, if you had a Pixel in the beginning, you got free unlimited storage. People abused it. Google shut that down, but you still had free unlimited high quality. It would compress videos, it would compress photos, save some space, but you could just keep uploading. It would back up everything. And so now Google is going to be getting rid of that. Sometime, what is it, June of next year? Whatever you upload to your Google storage is going to count against your storage. So you can back up in high quality, but you still have a limited bucket of how much stuff you can upload. And you got to pay for more cloud storage after that. But the way that these services are sort of built up on cool and popularity kind of parallels with a lot of our issues with social media. You come up with something new, it's really cool. You get like this tipping point where there's a bunch of people using the service, and then they try and figure out some other kind of monetization. So that's when ads start creeping in. Facebook is adding shopping to Instagram. So now, not just ads in your timeline, but they're going to be moving parts of your timeline so that you can buy directly in Instagram. You see something cool from an influencer, and then you get a link that you can buy it directly. You know, like, that's not what Instagram is. That's not what I liked using Instagram for, but what I liked using Instagram for was a cool service that kept me in touch with what my friends were sharing for their photos. And you can't really monetize that unless you make it paywall. So instead of making a paywall, they're just cramming it full of advertising and commerce now. Well, I'm not really using Instagram that much anyway. So same thing. You know, Google Photos transitioning out of this. I'm not sure I fully buy into the entire argument that Will is laying out in this article. And, you know, bringing up points like, oh, Google's motto used to be don't be evil. I don't see anything evil in Google turning off this service, you know, the unlimited aspect of this service. Nothing about that really seems sustainable, right? You know, we make so much digital content these days. You can't make an unlimited. Like, nothing about that makes sense. You can't make an unlimited in perpetuity. Like, that's never going to last forever. So, I bristle at some of that. Like, Google is still offering you substantially more cloud storage for free than Apple. There's still these great like inter-app coordinating services that benefit the end user and the consumer. There is competition in the market. I really used OneDrive more than I use Google Drive. If you're a Prime member, Amazon has some solutions that can benefit you. I'm a big proponent of making your own cloud. This last week, I've been gutting our home network. So I just installed a 10 gigabit Ethernet switch. I installed a 10 gigabit NIC in my desktop PC, and I'm going to be getting a new router just so that we've got faster Wi-Fi with 10 gigabit throughput from the router to my switch. I mean, you can make your own cloud. It can be real nice. My wife, we'll go out, go to a park. My wife shoots photos of Lex. She walks in the door, plugs in her phone, and it automatically triggers a data backup. And all of those photos and videos that she just shot, uploaded directly to our NAS. From my NAS, even if my desktop computer is off, I can share that content any way I want on any service, any platform, just download it directly to my own phone. I'm telling you, having more control over the servers that store that data is really nice. And it's not as prohibitively expensive as it used to be. This is still not a casual, oh, let me just buy an external hard drive kind of purchase. And I've definitely had some teething pains. Let me tell you about my issues going from SFP Plus to RJ45 with Cat 6A cable. Ha ha! But ultimately arriving at something that I have total control over and works better in most situations than a cloud service provider I would be subscribed to. Nick Fell, NAS is best life. Very true. So again, I thought this was an interesting twist on the normal, like, temper tantrum, stomping your feet. I'm mad at Google because Google did something I didn't like. But there is, I do feel there is a good faith argument for, we have zero regulatory control over these massive data brokerage companies. We have no consumer leverage over how they position products, sell them to consumers, get them hooked on some type of feature or functionality, and then pull the rug out from under them when it comes time to monetize. And I feel the next phase of the internet needs to be built on monetization up front. It needs to be built on a clearer disclosure of, this is how we're going to make this profitable. You're going to be a part of it as a consumer using the service. And then moving from here, you have to understand what our terms of service really are. You don't get that trying to read the terms of service. You know, a 1,000-page document in 0.8 font with a ton of legalese to obfuscate what the service is all about. We need to fix that. And we need general consumers to be more empowered in how they control their data, how they interact with their data, and how they do business with these mega corporations. So it's a ways to get there. I'm not doom and gloom on Google because they shifted their photo strategy. This is the educational moment. Because Google has done this, it provides us an opportunity to have this conversation with our family and friends and say, like, maybe you just need to plug a hard drive into your router. Maybe that's your cloud. And from there, you could be doing fine. Like, that could work. So we'll have to see. And from Geet Madden, even if you read that 1,000-page document, it starts with, we reserve the right to update this document without informing the customer, which is very true. All right, let's shift over into some Apple news. This podcast is going to run long, folks. There's no way around that because we still have a bit to get through here. Following up on some of that antitrust, the concerns over Apple and the App Store, all of these stories are going to kind of play into each other a little bit. Why maybe it's not a great idea to continue operating under Apple's current business model without some refinement. Again, it's not to say all or nothing, but even Apple, under their best conditions, could probably do with some market adjustments on how they interact with their own consumers. So I want to do a follow-up. We're still in the middle of the Epic Apple lawsuits. And it's never a good look for a plaintiff when a judge says you need facts to bring about this complaint. So this is coming by way of Ars Technica. Kyle Orland wrote this up over on Ars. Judge dismisses Apple's theft claims in Epic Games lawsuit. The underlying case, as regulars know, stems from Epic's August attempt to get around Apple's standard 30% fee on microtransactions by adding an Epic direct payments option to Fortnite on iOS. Apple considered this a breach of Epic's development contract and barred the game from the iOS App Store, a result leading Epic to immediately sue Apple for anti-competitive conduct. What Apple is claiming in here is that because Epic included their own payment processing service in the app that they stole from Apple, stole monies being exchanged, and stole intellectual property. And when the judge weighed in on that, hold on, I have to find, let me highlight this part from the article. As for the intentional interference claim, Rogers was not convinced that Epic's direct payment scheme amounted to an independent wrongful act separate from the core breach of contract issue as a matter of law. You can't just say it's independently wrong. You actually have to have facts. The judge kicking this argument out summarily and saying that it was somewhat baseless, that Apple was approaching this, that Apple's legal team was approaching this in bad faith. This wasn't a very strong argument for Apple to be making, and one that they didn't have data to support, that they didn't have the facts to support, which kind of flies in the face of what Tim Cook testified to that judiciary committee that we streamed, that when asked point blank about how some app developers get preferential treatment on the App Store as a platform, there are some criteria that allow you to do business on the Apple App Store with different commissions, even though everyone's treated the same. Some people are treated differently, but everyone's treated the same. And then when asked point blank, does Apple ever abuse its market position and bully individual developers? Tim Cook pointedly said, that's not a part of Apple's DNA. Apple would never abuse their market position like that. Apple would never seek out, you know, dissatisfied developers and make an example out of them in a court of law where they'd have to spend a humongous amount of money fighting Apple's legal team. That would never happen. And we saw that with WordPress. That was not correct. And now we're seeing it with Epic. And it's not like I'm on Epic's side. I don't think Epic is a very, I don't have any warm feels about Epic as a company, but they've got the pockets. They've got the pockets deep enough to actually ride this out in a court of law. And what do we see? We see when given the opportunity, Apple countersues, brings forth a counterclaim in a lawsuit where there really doesn't seem to be any foundation for their argument. And that's not a good look when the CEO of your company is testifying under oath before a judiciary committee saying, we would never do exactly what Apple does when they're confronted with a legal challenge. Something like this is nearly purposely designed to tie up the resources, the funds, and the legal team of someone who's bringing a complaint against your company. And instead of dealing with it, they're trying to hush it. They're trying to silence it by just being substantially more powerful and substantially better funded. So when a judge says you actually have to have facts, I think that speaks to the corporate culture, the character of Apple's corporate culture when they're confronted with people who are unhappy with their platform. Hopefully it brings about some kind of greater conversation where change can be implemented, where Apple can do business with developers in a more reasonable fashion while still claiming to protect the interests of the consumers on their platform. It would be nice, but this is going to be another 10 years in the making likely. So we'll have to just keep an eye on it as it goes. So moving on from that. So Apple keeps trying to improve or evolve their relationship with customers and consumers. We see this in the most recent iPhones. Apple has taken another step towards more aggressively controlling the parts on the iPhone. So now it's not just, does the phone try to verify whether the parts are official Apple components? You are not allowed to swap components from other registered iPhones. There was a really great teardown video where someone just switched a couple parts. Like, let's switch the camera modules. Well, they're all digitally signed and serialized. And so even though they are officially approved Apple components, you pulled a camera out of one phone and you put it into another phone. It wasn't like you sourced it on the black market or something. Because you don't have access to the Apple software to verify that serialized part, it breaks the camera. Screens, power buttons, batteries, all of these things are now increasingly locked up in a platform that makes it, every generation, it makes it more difficult, more expensive, and less open to maintenance, repair, and service a product. You have to jump through more hoops as a repair store to get access to the proper tools to manage this type of service. It's a bad look for a company that's saying they're trying to protect consumers and, you know, they're worried about the environment by making their products more disposable. And then they're also the single point of commerce, shopping. So they get to say when your gadget is dead and that you just need to buy a new one. We can't service this. I guess you'll just need to buy a new one. So it's great that Apple gives you better software updates than Android. And I bristle at the idea of better. It's just longer. Apple software doesn't evolve like Android. And we see plenty of issues when Apple software does make a big change that Apple can't really get it right. But you get longer. So even though it might have been a garbage performer out of the box, iOS 14 had tons of issues. You can sleep well knowing that in 2 years after Apple has stopped giving you new features, that they'll still be giving you those bug fixes and those security patches. Moving the Mac to a platform like that makes me very concerned for consumers. I was an Apple product specialist back in the glory days of IBM PowerPC G5s. I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again, that dual core, dual socket G5 Power Mac is still one of the most beautiful machines I've ever had my hands inside. I loved working on those Power Mac G5s. I was that most obnoxious Apple acolyte. Apple could do no wrong. Why would anyone ever want to shop anything else? This thing is the bestest. And then Apple walked away from me as a consumer. So Big Sur just came out and it broke a bunch of Macs. I want to start with this right here from Mac Rumors. And is there a byline on Mac Rumors? I don't see it. Or did I just miss it? Oh, from Hartley Charlton. Mac OS Big Sur update bricking some older MacBook Pro models. A large number of 2013 and 2014 13-inch MacBook Pro owners are reporting that the Mac OS Big Sur update is bricking their machine. And so Mac Rumors pointed this out. There's an Apple support thread. We're seeing the chatter and the conversation on Reddit. What was a part of the concern when this Big Sur update happened, CryptoHack blog actually broke down this process. And it's kind of a remarkable read. So the way that Apple verifies programs to work on a Mac, I'm grossly oversimplifying here. Please read this CryptoHack article if you want to dig in deeper. But because Apple's servers were tied up putting out the Big Sur update, the normal process for how apps are listed and verified was interrupted. Now, normally, when you interrupt this process, you can still open the app. So like you disconnect your internet, Apple can't sign the app properly. It still lets you use the program. Maybe sometimes it just gives you a pop-up saying, we couldn't verify this program. And you go, yeah, I know. And you click OK and you get on with it. But because their servers were tied up in a very specific way, the signal was showing that there was a connection to this verification process. The servers couldn't finish the verification process, bricks the Mac. Having that as a singular point of security, in my opinion, seems like a bad idea precisely because of what happened. So now you have to wait. What if this was your machine for work? What if this was your machine for school? You've got this inert lump of computer and that's all downtime for you. And that then compounds, well, wait a minute. Apple's all about privacy and security, but they're digitally signing all of the behavior that happens on my Mac. And we know that that's going to get more watchful, more intense when Macs are basically just iPads. When all of your software is really being put through the Mac App Store, as opposed to having a better process for third-party support on this new M1 chipset. So it's also not a good look when you see that there's a core group of Mac software and Apple apps that bypass firewall and VPN connections. This is written up by appleterm.com. Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
The Android Police Podcast comes at you three times a week to talk about the latest in Android news and to chat with our colleagues in tech media about wider subjects like the auto industry and what we do at trade shows. And we also do a fun Q&A stream each week, too. Catch us live on twitch.tv/AndroidPolice or listen anywhere you get your podcasts.
I love their update, too, by the way. They updated this two days ago. Since the original publication of this article, Mac OS Big Sur has exited beta and been released to the public. Despite this, there is no indication that Apple has changed this behavior. Some default Apple apps on Mac OS Big Sur, which remain in beta, bypass any network firewall or VPN connection a user has connected. This behavior was first spotted by Twitter user MXSWD and is more thoroughly explained by security researcher Patrick Wardle. According to Patrick, on older versions of Mac OS, a firewall could be set up using the network kernel extension, but on Mac OS Big Sur, Apple has deprecated the extension, which allows for many of their apps to bypass the firewall. Patrick provides two Mac OS Big Sur firewall examples, Lulu and Little Snitch. So this is frustrating. This is very frustrating because there's a part of this where the defense of Apple would probably be accurate. Longer term, software support, future updates. I bet you some of these concerns are ironed out, made better, improved upon. If this type of situation, in 1 week, we saw Mac updates bricking laptops, we saw apps not able to launch because of digital, because of verification and signage. And we saw company software, first party software from the manufacturer bypassing your security settings, VPN settings, firewall settings. If this had been Microsoft, the chatter would have been phenomenal. The Microsoft is always messing up. Microsoft is an evil corporation. Microsoft doesn't care about your privacy. They're not the company they used to be. This is the worst situation ever. We know it. We know that's what would have happened. If all of this had come out about Chrome OS in 1 week, we know what those talking points would have been. Google doesn't care about your privacy. They're actively trying to subvert, you know, your data security. They profit off of all of this and they sell it off to all these other companies. It's a terrible situation. It's the worst thing. It can't even matter. You need to stop doing business with Google. We know that's what it would have been. With Apple, it's, oh, well, they'll fix it. It's going to be fine. Apple has a vested interest in making sure that they control their platform in a way where consumers have no choice or competition. And we know that they've had issues with malware being digitally signed and verified. We know that they've had security issues where you could bypass, you know, someone's lock, some of the security settings on a Mac just by entering in random characters. We know that they don't get viruses like PCs, but malware still runs rampant, especially through browser exploits because Safari isn't that secure. But we know Apple will fix it. Just give them time. Just give them time. You know, it's just, if we give Apple enough time, then all these things are going to be just fine. And I feel like that's not fair. I feel like that's not great. I feel like that's anti-consumer. It's just frustrating. I want to be way more excited about the M1 chip because I think it's going to be a baller chip. I edit video on phones. I have been screaming at people for years now, since the Snapdragon 835, you have overpaid for processing power, you're not using it, you could be doing more. And of course, I keep getting met with, well, but I mean, your regular people aren't going to want to do that. It's jumping through hoops. You should never jump through a hoop or get more out of a product. It should just work. It should just be barely good enough to last the day and kind of work. And that's all you really need. You should spend more and buy more. And now Apple is finally giving us some expectation of better ARM performance for proper desktop grade apps. And of course, now everyone's flipped and like, oh, well, even like the A14 on my phone can like beat my iMac. Yeah. If you've been paying attention, we've been there. For a couple years now, and the A14 isn't magic, and the M1 isn't magic, and Apple's fake bar graphs with specious claims and very cagey, nebulous performance metrics, they're not magic. And it bums me out because I know the M1 is going to crush Intel at most of the price points where Intel would compete. Like, that's not controversial. Intel is in a holding pattern because they fell way behind in their chip fabrication, in their R&D, their product development. They had to face a number of core security concerns in their chips that some of their competitors didn't have to face, completely changing up their manufacturing process. We know. And Apple can't just come out and say, this spec laptop to this spec laptop, these are the types of performance metrics that we're trying to hit. It's, well, an M1 powered MacBook is 11 billion times more powerful than a leading selling laptop that we found on Amazon. And you're like, you want to try and dig into that. And I'm probably pretty confident it's not like, well, we took a $1,600 MacBook and a $1,600 PC, and this is a direct oranges-to-oranges comparison. It's probably like, well, the lead-selling laptop on Amazon is like a $500 Lenovo. And it's way more powerful than a computer that costs a third as much and is 2 years old. So that's Apple. Yeah, you don't want to buy one of them PCs. You want to buy a Mac. And just to me, it feels a lot like that crap I had to deal with my family, you know, like I had to get rid of my Dell. My Mac is so much better than my Dell. Well, how old was your Dell? It was like 5 years old and I never did any virus scanning or I never did any, hard drive wear leveling or decompression or anything. And I never upgraded the RAM and the chip. And when I bought that Dell, it was $500 new and it's like 5 years old. But my Mac is like way better. Well, how much did you spend on your Mac? Oh, it's like a $2,000 iMac. It's really nice. So you spent four times as much
and it's brand new, and you're comparing Apple to Dell. Oh, yeah. Apple's, like, way better. So just don't be like that guy. So here's my feeling. M1, I'm so critically excited for competition. M1 arrives at exactly the right time to kick Intel and AMD hard in the gonads. As I've been saying since the Snapdragon 835, ARM instruction set processors occupy this wonderful consumer space of power to performance to price. A beautiful triangle that really would benefit the consumer. But most of our legacy software needs to support this x86 operating system environment, Intel and AMD. I want you to think about all those times you heard people complain about various builds of Windows that were focused on a more app-based ecosystem. And every single time, geeks would wig out about legacy software. And what about supporting legacy software? What about legacy apps? That's the reason why you use Windows. And at the same time, Microsoft has faced actual antitrust and anti-consumer legislation and laws written literally against them, like the browser wars back in the day. And Apple has never really had to deal with any of that. They can always find a loophole. You need to have the same USB connector, unless you're an iPhone. Waka waka. So Microsoft has had to entrench legacy support because of that kind of nerd conversation and all of the institutions that use older PCs than they should. They don't have the luxury of just flipping a switch and saying, nope, apps from now on, because they would have been crucified for it. Anti-consumer behavior. They're trying to lock up the market. They're trying to dominate. It's a monopoly. Oh, we can't let them do this. It's going to be terrible for business and the economy and developers. Won't someone please think of the developers? So Apple gets a pass on all that. But at the same time, when we look at the ARM side of the hardware equation, Qualcomm needs more competition too. So I get really excited when I see a new Dimensity. Like MediaTek just put out another press release, and I can't get anyone on the phone from MediaTek just to have an interview. It's almost like MediaTek wants to fail in the market. But I want to talk about what else is going to shake up Qualcomm. Because it's like Qualcomm and Apple. I'm hoping the new Exynos is going to be cool. I'm hoping Google makes their own chipset, their own Google Silicon, so that they can compete in a more aggressive, more focused, and optimized way. It'd be nice if our next presidential administration can give the resources back to Huawei so we see another generation of Kirin. We need other parts. So M1 arrives at this perfect nexus between Intel and AMD dominating consumer-grade computers and Qualcomm basically being untouchable for competition in mobile tablets and smartphones. This is perfect. Apple could not have timed this better. I am so excited for this hardware. But the major component of every move Apple's made seems to be entrenched in consumer lockup, anti-consumer behavior, leveraging monopolistic business practices, fighting right to repair legislation, no upgrades, no serviceability, no repairability. When it wears out and it's a couple years old, just buy a whole new one because you can't do anything else with it. It's basically a tablet with a keyboard. And that's where I'm so frustrated with the current conversation around Apple, because those are fair criticisms, but the mainstream Apple commentary isn't going to tackle that. I got to get another drink of water here. Did I finish this mug? Let me finish this mug. From Aditya. Yo, Juan, I need you to take a minute, stretch, and breathe. This has been an intense couple of stories. And from Nick Fell, it's a shame that the best competitor to Qualcomm doesn't sell chips on the market. Oh, and Gabaletta, and proper stretch. Oh, ooh, just got some really nice shoulder pops in there. That was lovely. So, You're into Apple, you're into iPhones, you're into Macs. I want you to be excited about this stuff, but I also want you to keep a critical eye on this company that you're putting all of your eggs into this basket. And your products won't get better if we just assume that Apple's marketing is somehow truth. They're not really in it as an altruistic entity. They're in it as a trillion-dollar corporation that answers to shareholders and needs to demonstrate quarterly growth of profits. And that's true of Samsung. And that's true of Google. It's true of LG. They never really seem to get there. And it's true of Sony and all these other brands. Wearing that label isn't good for you if it also comes with you turning off that little section of critical thinking in your brain that your preferred lifestyle label can do no wrong. And that's what Apple has really entrenched in a bunch of the people that comment on Apple out of popularity, out of bias confirmation, and then also out of fear that if they stray, they'll be kicked out of that Apple club and they won't have the same access. So, I try not to do too much ASMR, even though I have this mic right on top of my face, but I'm not about like cracking my knuckles right into a microphone. That's kind of gross. All right, so we're running crazy long. I knew this was going to be a rambly podcast. Do want to highlight the subreddit this week because I totally kicked butt. Matt, you're going to be mad. You're going to be real mad. I don't even think Matt's watching anymore. I think he had to go. Every podcast has a Reddit. Excuse me. My subreddit is no exception. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Actually, hold on. Before I go into the screen share here, a couple housekeeping subreddit comments to make. I used If This Then That, IFTTT, to feed stories from a handful of content creators so that the Reddit would always be kind of up to date and populated with some content. It's really good for my karma score on Reddit because, you know, even the handful of upvotes that I get, sometimes it's a little spammy when a bunch of videos hit all at the same time, but it was a way to make sure that stuff was still fresh. Like you wouldn't come to the subreddit 2 days later and see the same stories just kind of in limbo. When IFTTT shut a bunch of stuff down, it changed how I organize all that. And so there are still some holes in getting content. Like Zach Talks Tech reached out to me and was like, hey man, I don't see my videos on the subreddit anymore. And it's because I don't have a reliable method that works as well for posting content automatically. And I don't want it to be a manual process for me because I have enough on my plate. So I would highly encourage those of you who are following different content creators who are trying to share content that you also look at maybe some kind of IFTTT style auto publish. If it gets spammy, I'll shut it down as a moderator. But as a way to keep content moving, you want to see Zach Talks Tech videos and they're not reliably getting shared from me. This is where we need that active participation. People joining the community. If you want to share manually, that's great. If you want to set up a sort of an auto trigger that can publish this stuff, I'm good with that too. It's really more, we want to keep conversations going in a way that is more fair than how YouTube is going to serve content on their platform. As YouTube kind of, you know, it's algorithms. Algorithms are gross. So, DTNO, Wana is karma AF. Not even close, man. I've got a combined karma score of 14K. Nah, brah. Nah. All right. Back to the subreddit. I win. top two stories of the week. Number one, my video on the silver play button was the leading story of the week. And then last week's podcast, where we checked out the OnePlus Nord, Samsung beats Apple, FTC to sue Facebook, Trump loses Twitter protections. That was the number two spot. Two doofy looking guys in hats with punchable faces. And I totally win. And number three, Tech PhD with 679 subscribers checking out the iPhone 12 Pro in gold. Hands-on video from someone with less than 1,000 subscribers upvoted to the number 3 spot. I am so stinking proud of this community. That Tech PhD is nowhere to be found. I'm subscribed to Tech PhD. I just had to double check. I am subscribed to Tech PhD. Never see Tech PhD content in my stream of YouTube videos. 679 subscribers, hasn't broken 1,000, making content on a really expensive premium tier phone from Apple, number 3 on Glowing Rectangles. Those of you who are actively participating on Glowing Rectangles, upvoting content, sharing from the subreddit to other communities, that is huge. That is such a huge shot in the arm to help with the visibility and the promotion and the awareness. It triggers algorithms. Software starts seeing like, oh, well, we saw a couple views coming in on this video from Reddit. Maybe it's more popular than we thought it was. All of that helps a content creator out so much. You watch a video and then you move on with your life, that's fine. But the active participation is what keeps content creators making more new stuff for you to consume. Tech PhD, I hope you break 1,000 soon because it's cool content. Again, this it's so much fun finding these up-and-coming channels. That was number three. Number 4, Sony Xperia 5 Mark II real-world camera test coming by Josh Vergara. Number 6, the folks at Newegg wanted me to do an editorial on mobile gaming. That got some traction. We got some fun videos. I reshared some stuff from Lisa at Mobile Tech Review on the Moto Razr, the Pixel 5, and the MSI Creator 17 laptop. We got a TCL 10 5G UW review coming by Jay Williams. And again, there was a bit of controversy on another channel's live stream. I think it was actually on Ted's live stream where people were like, wait a minute, Jay Williams is not a small content creator. Why are you sharing his stuff? And the goal of this subreddit is not only share stuff from the smallest content creators. The goal of this subreddit is share content you feel deserves more attention. And I feel Jay Williams, even with 120,000 YouTube subscribers, deserves more attention than just having 120,000 YouTube subscribers. I feel that number should probably be tripled. I don't know if you've watched Jay Williams' content, but I think it's really good. So that's why I feel very comfortable adding him to this subreddit and sharing his stuff, not because he really needs my help in boosting his numbers, but because he is deserving of even more traffic than he's currently getting. So, and from Ted, from Saeed Ted, it's hard to find a small tech tuber on YouTube. My feed will always show Linus and MKBHD. DTNL, Juan, there's a small-time YouTuber who once bent an iPhone and gained a lot of views. I don't know where he is nowadays. He's always in my recommended subscribers list because I don't really like, playing that game with YouTube content. I just subscribed to someone who has 678 subscribers, YouTube. Why are you serving me more channels with millions of subscribers? But I digress. Just a few more just to kind of point out, because I thought this was some fun stuff. Team Vry, 1,000 subscribers. Pixel 4a versus 3a camera comparison. We've got Shannon Morse. And again, she's been putting out more general tech reviews. First of all, her hair is amazing. But Shannon is one of the more knowledgeable voices on social media today about security. So especially when you start talking about these digital security concepts, if you're not following Shannon Morse, you're missing out on a really savvy voice in the privacy and security landscape. Painfully Honest Tech, looking at Apple Silicon Max, and Tech Odyssey, taking a look back at the BlackBerry Porsche 99893. he's definitely I love BlackBerries. He takes it to yet another higher tier. So support contribute, share, upvote. Don't be stingy with the upvotes. I mean, this is a very grassroots subreddit. It is built from the ground up to be user participation and real person participation. I'm not dumping bots on there to try and blow up content. I want it to be a real organic place to find new content creators that you've never seen before, to engage with new content. It's gotten a step more difficult with the way that IFTTT has changed their policies for me to automatically share all this stuff. So if you want a greater variety, a broader community, more voices, more perspectives, more point of views, we need more active participation. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangle. Every week, y'all do me proud. I love seeing what gets voted to the top, especially when it's me, because I'm awesome. But even when it's not me, it's still amazing to see what stories really get upvoted, as opposed to what stories are just served to us because they're supposed to be trending topics. That's what we want in our tech discussion. We want authenticity, and you can be a part of it. You can help make something authentic, or you can keep just consuming whatever algorithm is designed to keep you on the platform longer. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and I hope you check it out. Ah, all right. Moving right along. Let me get this out of the way here. Sorry, I just saw some of these comments like Aditya Anil. Snubs is an evil scientist who hacks for good. Snubs is the online username for Shannon Morse. I got to hang out with her two CESs ago, and she was a brilliantly fearless individual. Like, we were at this influencer event. I think it was for Alienware. Was it? Yeah, it might have been a Dell event. Anyway, Glitch Mob was performing, and let me tell you, if you ever worry about blowing out your hearing, take earplugs if you ever go to see Glitch Mob. But Shannon, like, ran right up to the front fence and just started taking photos and selfies and video of her right in front of Glitch Mob, and, like, the security detail really didn't even know what to do. Like, well, she's absolutely not allowed to be right here, right? And then had to, like, escort her off, like, away from the stage. It was incredible. She is super, super cool. All right. Let me get this out of the way here. I'm not trying to pick on the iPhone. I'm trying to pick on the iPhone just a little bit. We all know I'm picking on the iPhone, but this was by way of Engadget. John Fingus, iPhone 12 mini owners report unresponsive lock screens. This is kind of adding to a collection of issues that we've seen slowly start get ironed out from iOS 14. If you saw my Pixel 5 review, I talked very much that the finish, like the coating and the material on these new iPhones, seems to be kind of fragile, gets rubbed off pretty easily. Max Weinbach cracked the back glass really easily on his iPhone 12. I bring these up because I feel like these types of issues happen on an iPhone and everyone's like, oh, but Apple will sort it out. And when these issues happen on other platforms, oh, the other one, green tint, iPhone OLEDs, they're not 90 hertz or 120 hertz, but they still have issues with gray crush and green tint. The OLEDs just don't like having lower brightness settings enabled, just like everyone else. And I bring this up because, again, Apple will get every consideration. Apple will get every excuse. Apple will get every defense. And it's the exact same kind of problems that if another manufacturer had those issues, they'd be crucified for. Samsung gets a little bit of this protection too. Like, look at all of the screen issues the Galaxy S20 FE has had. Touch response issues, some of the OLED green and gray tint issues. Samsung has not been able to fix this yet with a software update. Even though Samsung is way better at software than LG, they haven't fixed screen touch response problems on the FE. You know, so again, it's as soon as you have a popularity bias in play, they get special consideration and special defense that less popular manufacturers will never get. I believe at some point, Apple will probably sort out their issues on the iPhone 12. If you bought an iPhone 12 mini and you have an unresponsive touchscreen, It doesn't matter. You have an unresponsive phone. Your phone is not working, is not just working. Your phone is having a problem, and you need to go and spend time and extra energy and effort in getting that problem sorted. It's no different for an iPhone owner than it would be for a Sony owner or a Motorola owner or an LG owner, minus the fact that you might have access to an Apple store for at least some slightly faster logistics. If you're waiting for software updates, you're in the same boat as any other product which has some kind of bug or fix or issue or QA problem. Apple's not magic. They are a manufacturer of consumer electronics, and they seem to have the exact same issues as any other manufacturer. They don't seem to be any better or more bulletproof in that regard. TK Bay, I had that issue on Sunday. And everyone say, hey, TK, I'm glad you could jump in, you could join. Another person you should be subscribed to, following, and has a brilliant stream on Saturdays. So I want to spend a little time on this because, again, I feel like it seems like it's too soon to be over all of the phones that Samsung just recently put out, like Note 20s, Fold 2s, Galaxy S20 FEs. But, you know, if we want those clicks, if we want that traffic, we want to monetize that traffic, well, we need to be talking about next year's phones. We're already into next year's phones. It's not even worth it. Why would you even buy a phone this year? You shouldn't even buy a phone next year, because then we'll need to talk about phones in 2022. And when you're in 2022, you shouldn't buy a phone, because the phones in 2023 are going to be even better. Yeah. So there you go. Android Police put out a whole spec sheet on, they're claiming they've got all of the leaks for the Galaxy S21. And we're going to see a trio of phones, an S21, an S21 Plus, and an S21 Ultra. I don't know. So far, the rumors are pointing to Snapdragon 875s or Exynos 2100s, similar battery capacities to what the phones had this year, similar cameras to what the phones have this year, similar RAM and storage to what the phones have this year, a slightly different design. You know, the module, camera module on the back, is still going to be a big old fat domino. I don't know. It's a little underwhelming. One of the major rumors pointing to this is that the Galaxy S21 Ultra will have S Pen support. And I'm going to be real mad I think it's pretty clear. At some point, the Note goes away, right? You have to include more compromises to have a stylus silo in the phone. You have to shrink the battery. Like, you can't really work around all of these space volume issues on a phone. So the Note doesn't feel as special when, yeah, it's got an S Pen silo that you can keep the pen in the phone, but it comes at the expense of, you know, what, like 5% of the battery, 10% of the battery? I can't even remember at this point. So I'm going to be frustrated if we make a big play out of, well, now the Galaxy S has stylus support. And isn't that great? You don't have to be married to having the stylus in the phone. You can just buy a stylus and use it when you need it, because that's LG's strategy. LG did that this year. LG did it first on every one of their larger screened mid-range to premium devices, the Velvet, the V60, the Wing. Active pen, stylus support, and the digitizer is in the Stylo 6, but the software doesn't really properly support it the same way as the more expensive phones. What have we heard? Well, it's not as valuable to just have stylus support, because what happens if you lose the stylus because it's not in the phone? And I guarantee you, the second Samsung does this, you're going to have a bunch of Samsung Knights going, well, isn't this better for choice? Isn't it better that Samsung is doing this. They're making their product line less complicated. They're not pretending that the Note and the S are different phones anymore. If you want the stylus support, you can buy it. It's just an accessory and all phones can support it. And isn't that going to be better for consumers? While they were panning the exact same move from LG for not being as consumer friendly, because it might be easier to lose the stylus. And that to me is, again, a part of the galling conversation that we're having with this kind of tech stuff.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
From Gabaletta. Side note, I was in a T-Mobile store and I watched the sales rep discourage the V60 with the dual screen case that's priced at $649 to try and sell the S20 FE for $699 when the customer was like, "But this one has two screens." Yeah, I get a lot of stories about that. In fact, I actually reached out to Ask Dez on Twitter. Dez does all of those crazy unboxing videos for T-Mobile. And someone wrote me like this really upset. I was there. I was trying to buy this phone. The sales rep actively tried to talk me out of it. They were rude, blah, 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 blah. And like, I put them in touch. It was like, talk to Dez, and Dez talked to this other guy. And like, it was actually kind of cool. You know, like at the high end, T-Mobile doesn't care. T-Mobile doesn't care if you own a Galaxy or an LG or an iPhone. They want subscribers, right? So anything that gets in the way of like having the most subscribers and being able to like show their investors, you know, growth over time, they're all about that. But on the ground floor, you walk into the carrier store and you're immediately greeted by iPhones. And then the second table is Samsung. And then way off in a dusty corner is the others. Like on the ground floor, like those individual sales reps are going to be all about trying to push popularity and familiarity and getting probably some nice spiffs, deals, you know, breaks, bonuses based on individual phone sales. So it's, you're definitely going to see a lot of that. But again, it's we're looking at the next generation of phones. These phones are going to get even more expensive. The Snapdragon 875 is going to be using new ARM cores in this chip. And it's probably going to be a huge shot in the arm to catch up on the performance of the A14 that just came out for the iPhone. We've always seen that kind of TikTok off year, right? The iPhone that launches at the end of 1 year is really designed to fight the phones that are coming out at the beginning of the next year, not in the same year. So the A14 really isn't the competitor for the 865. It's the competitor for the 875. But like the stuff doesn't sound like it's really lighting me up. Across the board, Samsung will be adding more features to the camera. All of the cameras will support 4K 60 frame per second recording. Minus the selfie camera, the LG V50 with a Snapdragon 855 had 4K 60 frame per second software stabilized video recording on the main sensor in the ultra wide. Why did we give that up? If we supposedly care about that now, We had it on the LG V50.
But the LG V50 isn't good enough.
And it's still competitive against phones that are going to be coming out next year. I'm willing to bet pretty good money that the actual video quality and bitrate on an LG V50 still going to be competitive against what Samsung can put out on an S21. I mean, come on. We can't have memories that short. I know a bunch of really popular YouTubers were like, oh, wow, Apple invented 4K 60 with software stabilization, except for the fact that LG did it first. But still, we're acting like this is going to be a huge feature on the S21. Yeah, not so much. Super steady stabilization will be improved to 60 frames per second recording. Camera will be able to automatically switch between 30 and 60 frames per second, depending on the lighting conditions. Let me tell you, as someone who shoots a lot of content from phones, you don't want that. You want to lock your frame rate and your shutter speed. You don't want to let the phone decide for you when it's going to flip on and off. Samsung is adding 8K at 30 frames per second instead of 8K at 24 frames per second, which is impressive as a technological feat, but I still haven't found many situations where I really want that 8K footage from a phone, especially in how we resolve the clarity of content off of the optics of a smartphone sensor. It's probably not that useful, except in some very specific professional grade situations where even then I'd probably still want to shoot 4K 60, not 8K 30. Aditya Anil, is the 8K 26 frame per second on the LG V60 usable? It's usable. And it is. It is a higher clarity of content. But I feel the compromises, the frame rate, the look of the video, all of the things that I care about as a creator, I prefer shooting everything in 4K 60. I can drop that to 4K 30 or 4K 24. I can stretch it. So I always have a built-in half-speed slow motion. Everything is more useful for me at 4K 60. And it's why I was also kind of bummed that LG walked back the camera sensor on the V60 ultra wide so it could only do 4K 30. Drove me nuts. Again, there's quite a bit of content on my channel that's shot from a phone. And even this year, a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that content is still coming from the V50. I've got a walk and talk vlog that I needed to use the ultra wide. So that did not come from a V60. That came from a V50. So yes. Sorry. Getting back to this and just kind of wrapping up our news and topics and stories and it's not on Android Police. You know, you've got to monetize the traffic to your website and push those ads and get those clicks and get those eyeballs. And they've got a leak and we're super hyped up about leaks. But increasingly, the high-end premium tier smartphone conversation is mired in this lowest common denominator average consumer mindset. There are going to be things about the Galaxy S21 Ultra, which are going to be awesome. But we're also going to be talking probably about a $1,400 or $1,500 phone. So we're going to have to suffer all of the people who are like, well, it's not worth it to buy premium phones. But they're still using all of their phones like basic communicators from 3 years ago. Oh, people don't edit video on their phones. Well, now they do because Apple said you could. But if you're not pushing into any new territory, if you're not trying to increase the work you do from a mobile device, then you shouldn't be shopping at the premium tier. You should be shopping at increasingly lower price points to facilitate that average consumer use. I'd like everyone to start repeating, average consumers buy average phones. It's not magic. Now, again, if your needs haven't changed in 3 or 4 years, there's no reason for you to spend more than $400. None. You're good. Settle down. Even the Fashion Flex doesn't work anymore because we're not going out like we used to. Can't show off my $1,500 phone when we're in lockdown and under quarantine. All right. So, wrapping this all up, first of all, I do want to just kind of tease out, I'm going to have a social media post out later today as being a member of Team Pixel. New Chromecast, I'm not breaking any crazy news here, and I'm not like blowing anyone's mind, but this has been one of the best upgrades for my living room in years. A couple years back, I bought a really nice Samsung smart TV, and I absolutely hate it. Smart TVs are some of the dumbest consumer electronics we have to suffer using. The interfaces are terrible. The UIs are awful. The updates are non-existent. And the way that they handle apps and services is miserable. I will never buy another premium tier Samsung TV. Their new strategy and their new policy on advertising has gone from, first of all, it was just bad enough when it was like a little teeny advertisement that was the same size as the other apps in your sort of home layout, your home screen. Now, when I'm shifting between different inputs, I'm getting a third of the screen strip of advertising blocking what I'm trying to switch inputs to. On a premium TV that I spent a lot of money on. So I don't love the idea of another remote. I really liked the idea of the original Chromecast where I'd pull up my phone, I'd push a button, and then something would pop up on my TV. It's often still just faster for me to find something on my phone and cast it up to my TV. Unfortunately, we're just too well-trained. Like, my wife wants a remote. She wants to kind of like scan through things. She wants better control over YouTube TV or Sling or whatever we're subscribed to now. I can't even remember. I get why remotes won, but I really wanted that phone experience to be how we just seamlessly connected different devices. It's not what took off. But having that remote and being able to program the remote to control the Samsung TV, to control the inputs, and to control our sound bar is kind of nice. For $50, you get a reasonably decent universal remote and a Chromecast. And when you look at all these other programmable universal remotes, it's kind of silly how expensive they still are. So that was a nice little value add in that I never, ever, ever have to interact with Samsung's UI ever again. And that to me is like, that's worth the price of admission right there. The fact that it's not that expensive, I mean, it's a little pricey for a streaming stick, but it's a little bit more than just a streaming stick. Real good. I'm real happy. It's really nice. From Hargle Blargle, having just gotten a free Chromecast Ultra, would you recommend I buy the new Chromecast anyway? I would not. I would play with the Ultra for just a bit and see if it's going to do you fine. What I always wanted was a remote control app for my phone so that you could control your TV and your Chromecast like you would control, have the remote built in there. If you remember in the glory days when all phones had IR blasters, you know, like I wanted a universal remote app that worked through the Chromecast service. But use that Ultra for a while first. See if that's good enough for you. I mean, again, I generally prefer the casting experience of throwing from phone to TV. And if that lines up with you, do that. If you really do want that tactile, I have the thing that is sort of anatomically shaped to control my TV, then I would say consider picking up the new Chromecast. I'm increasingly of the mind that we should stop flipping these gadgets every year. Give it some time, see if you like it, and go from there. It's impossible to know You know, if you like the casting service, rock the casting service. Like, if you think you need a remote, then do that, I guess. Oh, and from Geet Madden, Google is offering YouTube Premium subscribers a free Chromecast and Stadia controller. So if anyone in the chat is a YouTube Music subscriber, go grab your Chromecast Ultra. And I am not. We were flipping back and forth between YouTube TV and Sling, and I've never been a YouTube Premium subscriber, so that hasn't worked. Gabaletta, again, stuff like this, it's kind of funny. The other night, me and my girlfriend wanted to finish watching the last season of Lucifer. Even though we have smart TVs, we ended up using Dex because it was just a better experience than the Netflix that's in our smart TVs. Yeah. Oh, that's where I was too. I've got my Nook. My Core i9 beast of a mini workstation Nook is also behind my TV. And most of the time I like going through the Nook better than I like going through the smart TV. It's kind of a bummer. Well, one of the other reasons I wanted to bring this up is the YouTube, the Team Pixel folks set up this really cute care package. So when you're on that hashtag Team Pixel, we used to do these in-person events, like got to meet some amazing cinematographers. We went down to the YouTube studio and like learned some camera technique and some lighting techniques, some really cool stuff. And I was talking to them about trying to set up a workshop on microphones. But we can't do that anymore. So they sent over for the premiere of the new season of The Crown. I don't know if y'all are into The Crown, but it's this box behind me. This is like giant red leather box. I have like a photo album, a photo book. You can see like photos of Princess Diana visiting the Australian outback. And it's just like really cute and really well put together. But one of the things that kind of blew me away was it's got a really nice China teacup. If you'll pardon the ASMR. Like, it's real China. And like, they include like some tea bags and some digestives, so that you can enjoy the new season of The Crown. So, I was just really impressed. It was a really nice little way to get a Chromecast, as part of a review kit. It was more of a care package. Like, hey, we know stuff sucks. Enjoy streaming some content on Netflix. It's pretty nice. and I do enjoy a nice cup of English breakfast. I'm more of a chai oolong kind of a guy. If you mix a chai and an oolong, you get a very cider kind of flavor out of it. But I'm definitely down for some good English black tea. So it's good times. We should probably wrap this podcast up. I kind of teased it at the very beginning, and I wanted to save it to the end of this because I stream this podcast on Twitch. I'm trying to keep some consistent conversation going about my concerns with other video streaming platforms like the YouTubes. I now have, if I can grab it without bumping the mic too much, shouldn't have put it way over there. But, you know, I now have a YouTube silver play button presented to Juan Bagnell for passing 100,000 subscribers. And this is going to be a little repetitive if you caught my video. Let me put this back down on the ground a little closer to me. If you caught my video where I talked about finally getting this play button, but for the podcast audience or people who stream the audio version of this show, I broke 100,000 subscribers late last year, late 2019. Actually, pretty close to now. So there was a time where this kind of an accomplishment was something that I was hyper fixated on, where every video I was chewing through my metrics and my analytics and keywords and the SEO and changing titles and trying to swap out thumbnails. even though I'm not very good at Photoshop and it takes forever to make an okay thumbnail, let alone a stupid, wacky face thumbnail. There, not too long ago, there was this like entrenched goal. There was this like desire for the validation of making stuff on YouTube. Over the last couple years, and as I've watched the YouTube platform migrate from the original idea of homegrown, user-generated, and shared video, my focus on being a content creator has changed in an opposite direction from where I feel YouTube is heading. And I've seen, even on my own channel, approaching content in a different way, trying to diversify content, trying to have different kinds of conversations is not SEO popular. And it's devalued from YouTube. And I say this in the video. Increasingly, it feels like YouTube is a gatekeeper between you and your community rather than a facilitator helping a content creator grow. And I feel like that's been weaponized to a point where there are like different tiers of YouTube and you get different rules to play by based on how popular you are. Every time there's a major problem on YouTube, it usually comes from some major channel having a meltdown, some really, really big channel pissing off advertisers. It's very rarely the smaller people that are building up at the low end. But every time YouTube addresses those concerns, those policies hit the smaller content creators way harder than the larger ones. Dave Burns is saying PewDiePie, cough, cough. I was actually thinking Jake and Logan Paul. Again, for one of the last major adpocalypses came directly out of those shenanigans. And those guys weren't affected at all. But I'll tell you, it changed all of the metrics for how you get monetization in the first place and moved the goalposts on a bunch of creators, making it even more difficult to work on YouTube's platform. And at the same time, you know, it's like all the hoops we jump through to, you know, comply with COPPA, comply with FTC disclosure regulations, to comply with DMCA notices, with intellectual property issues. It's difficult. It's really not the fun, carefree, wild west of, you know, experimental content that it used to be. And we should expect that. But I also feel like because of the way that YouTube has automated so much of this, it's really given rise to some of the most toxic aspects of commentary, of community. It's a radical explosion of content farms that are able to game all of YouTube's systems, but then they generate so many views and so much revenue. Well, YouTube probably won't investigate those dozens of channels operating under one big umbrella, repeating content, making fake content, and monetizing all of that because it's good for YouTube's bottom line. It's good for YouTube's bottom line to have more artificial fake content farms than it is to empower individual content creators to make better content. And so that's why we see this echo chamber. It's why we see this vicious loop and cycle in the kinds of content that people are willing to produce. You know, it's very fast. My channel is guilty of this too. It's almost immediate, where if you build up any kind of an audience in one community, it's sort of your job or responsibility to then pivot and make your channel a commentary channel about the community. So if you're into tech, it's not just, well, let me review this phone and let me talk about some of the tech news. It's also, now let me also comment on all of the other tech channels. Let me dredge up the tech drama. And because there's drama, ooh, that's a bit more exciting and titillating and salacious. And then that becomes its own feedback loop at the same time. So, it's a very difficult position to be in now, because the validation from YouTube isn't that important to me anymore. I say the exact same thing in that YouTube video. I'm not just hiding on Twitch to angrily wag my fist in YouTube's general direction. I put that up first and foremost. You know, these are my grievances with where YouTube has gone on YouTube. But this is also, it's one of those milestones and it's one of those markers. I really wish I had taken the time to better say thank you when I did break 100,000 subscribers. I waited to see if YouTube would send me a play button. And I really don't think that was fair. And now I really, now that I've got the play button, I really don't think that was appropriate for all of the people that have been supporting the channel this whole time. And at the time, I was sort of validated but frustrated, and I wanted to see what YouTube would do, so I put it on pause. I really should have made a bigger deal out of that when it happened. And so that's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to cap this on the podcast today, is something of an apology, where waiting this long to make my point, I feel this is a very, this is a point that is valuable to me. It's a conversation I think is important, but it came at the expense of properly acknowledging and celebrating and thanking the community of people that have been along for the ride. So now I'm saying thank you because YouTube finally did something. And I should have said a better thank you before now. But now that it's here, it's at least still the same, a similar opportunity to thank people that are down for this kind of conversation. This is the geeky, nerdy conversation I want to have. And I'm kind of okay if it's not the biggest community. I care more about the quality than I do the quantity of views and comments and replies and shares that I get. So at least now I can kind of rectify or course correct or try to fix my own hubris and my own pride, preventing me from better celebrating the people that I care about when I should have. So, this is the right time to say thank you. Like I say in the YouTube video, this is a little repetitive, but after getting this play button, it really wasn't what was important. All of the validation that I was seeking, all of the, you know, the kudos, I want a plaque to commemorate this really cool thing that I did. And every day it's just shown to me time and time again. I go to a Discord, I go to my comments on YouTube, I fire up Twitter, some places where you can get stuck in some of the most toxic conversations. And yet I'm finding the best discussions to be a part of, the kinds of real nerdcore stuff that I just genuinely adore. And I'm finding them from real people who care. You know, again, very rarely completely agree with me, but they genuinely care about getting a bit deeper into this than just, well, that's what the commercial said, so I guess that's good enough for me. And that's invaluable. It's why I do this show every week. It's like, I got to get fired up for the week. And I know I've got a community here that's genuinely interested and engaged in having a conversation. That's not just read me the specs and show me the pretty B-roll. So, it's an opportunity, and I want to take this opportunity now because I didn't take this opportunity when I should have, but it's an opportunity to say thank you. And to say, let's keep having some fun. And even though the world is in a crazy place, and I hope people out there are staying safe, and I know we're probably in for another round of lockdowns and quarantining orders, and we've got some serious issues to hammer out with medical professionals and schools and businesses, I feel like we're getting through this because we're able to get through it together. I feel like we're doing better because we're able to do this together. So I very much appreciate those of you along for the ride, and I hope I'm contributing to some fun in your own techie, geeky proclivities. And I want to keep doing this, and I want to keep doing this with folks that care. So, Dave Burns,
salt shakers.
From Q3 Becker, it's just a number, or so they say. See, my family is very much into that any excuse for a party, right? So, like, we're not Jewish, but Rosh Hashanah sounds pretty cool. Let's do it, you know? for me, you know, a holiday, if it's gimmicky, you know, like a Mother's Day or a Father's Day, you know, again, it can be just crass and commercial, or you can use it as some way for yourself to kind of remember something that's important to you. And so this is why I'm feeling a little not great about how I handled 100,000 is I should have made a bigger deal out of celebrating this community at that time. So it is, I mean, it's just a number, and I've grown, you know, I think I'm at like 120,000 subscribers now, you know, over the course of 1 year, I'm growing even faster just because I've had more people subscribe. But at the same time, like, I want to use those numbers as a way to better say kudos and say thank you. And I'm going to try and do a better job of that in the future. Gabaletta, we appreciate you and all your hard work. We as a community know how grateful you are, and know that as that us as a community are aware of this. And I appreciate that. And I don't want it to go this long again. You know, when I break 200,000, we're going to do something fun. And we're going to do something fun just because it's for us. And I'm not going to get any play button or any special recognition or award or anything like that, but it's for us. And that's what I want to do more of. Yeah. At DTNO, I'm all about the party life as long as it ends by 11 p.m. because I got to go nighty night. At DTNO, at 420,000, we all know the drill. Nice. Dave Burns with the proper yeet. So, got a lot of stuff coming out. I'm going to do a write-up on Chromecast. I think I'm finally wrapping my brain around this little Fio. I teased this a while back and then just got swamped with phone reviews. And I really need this to get some light. The Q3 from Fio, just an amazing little amp, a little DAC, just to treat yourself to some ear candy. I'm going to have a Galaxy Note 20 Ultra camera review. That's going to be kind of a big deal. I shot that, and I just need to edit that down. So there's going to be some fun stuff. There's going to be a lot of cool stuff coming out on the channel this week. I'm probably going to be slow playing Apple the end of this year. I'm hoping to spend time iPhone 12 maybe in January, because I just don't feel any burning desire to flip that switch to just ride the hype train. I'd rather see how this stuff improves with some updates and some support. So, yeah. And if there are any other questions, comments, concerns, if you have a really good idea for what I should do with my play button, maybe if there's a place I should mount it, or if it should go up on the bookcase behind me, or maybe just should live in a nicely covered box in my closet, share some thoughts. I'm kind of curious what people might think. I mean, aside of the obvious, like, oh, well, YouTube sucks, you should just destroy it, I don't really feel like that's appropriate, but I'm also still real proper torn in my relationship with YouTube. So, share some thoughts. I'd be curious to see what folks come up with. And, you know, of course, the rest of this is all about catching y'all on the rest of the internet and the social medias. So hopefully we're still going to have some fun conversations on Twitters and Discords and YouTubes. And I'm never on Facebooks. So you can kind of stop trying to reach me on Facebooks. That's not really a thing. So, folks, I am... Oh, and Patreons. Yeah, definitely on the Patreons too. I've been getting a few more really fun comments on the Patreon, and I think maybe I might need to do like an entire podcast of Patreon questions and Patreon reviews, because folks there are actually making some really cool stuff. Dave Burns, you can catch me on Parler. I did sign up for Parler, if only to lock down some gadget guy so that someone else couldn't be me on Parler. So folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Thank you so much. Again, greatly appreciated for all of the fun, nerdy chats that we get to have. But stay safe. Really, seriously, look around. Look for your family. Look for your friends. Look after your neighbors. If we learn anything from what's going on around us in the world today, it's that we can rise to this occasion. We can be better friends and we can be better neighbors. And I'm preaching to the choir that I know so many of you already live up to that standard. So thank you. Thank you for being good neighbors, and thank you for being good tech neighbors. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the podcast. Be well. Take care. I love y'all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.